That's it. You've made it. Welcome to Side 71 of Spider on the Web. Follow in your book as we learn three new words in English. Very hard choices. That, coincidentally, is the title of my latest novel, which is, as we speak, finally being released in the format that, let's admit, it matters most of all to us both, the paperback. That's right, on the very day I'm recording this podcast, Very Hard Choices, sequel to Very Bad Deaths, was at last made available to a public starved for thoughtful entertainment in a Bain Books paperback edition. If you want to hit the pause button right now while you race out and score a few copies, I'll entirely understand. Go ahead. I'll be right here.
Aching arms and dusty boots and a job that won't get done. 2 weeks past and yesterday the fleet changed for spot on. Day to day, long hard day, not a thing to call your own. And the boy turns and he asks his old man, said, oh, are you glad for the time that I do have? Says, life is good. Fingers in the air. You got $2 in your pocket, a little bit of cream in your hair. You know life is good when you're part of a doo-doo. Oh, giving you love for others, and it all comes back to me. Some guys are handsome, and they make friends all the time. Where they go, we got a buddy, and they always feel fine. Others take a back seat and they watch the world go by. They're living life alone, just quietly inside. But then love strikes and those fires start to burn. In those lonely years they melt away, and finally it's your turn. And you say life is good, winter's blowing cold. All love is together and it never will grow old. You know life is good and you're part of a doo-doo. Oh, giving you love for others and it all comes back to you. You can go year to year thinking life has nothing new. Goes and changes just like that. You said life is good. You're heading for a fall, and you pick yourself up and dust yourself off, and it didn't hurt at all. You know life is good when you're part of a doo-doo. Well, give your all to others. Come on now, try. Listen very closely to every laugh and sigh. Maybe there's a reason for all we do. Giving it all to others, it all comes back to me. Oh, give to you.
All right, that was Livingston Taylor, some of you may know as the brother of Alex, Hugh, and Kate, with a song I've always dearly loved. Life is good if you're proud of what you do. Give your all to others, and it all comes back to you. I'm very proud of what I do, and as I was saying earlier, the sensible thing for me to do at this point from a business point of view would be to read you some enticing excerpts from my newest paperback, Very Hard Choices, in hopes of deepening your realization that you need it in your life. But Astute, adoring, or merely anal listeners to this podcast will surely recall that I already did that a little over a year ago when Bain originally released the hardcover edition. I read a lot of the book back then over a period of 7 separate episodes of this podcast. I can't read any more without having basically given away the whole story, and I ain't gonna do that. Now, I know at the time some of you may have thought it over and said to yourself, man, I can't afford hardcover prices, and there's no sense in flaming my desire for a book I won't be able to afford to buy until next year. So you might have skipped those episodes of the podcast, and even if you caught them, you may have forgotten a lot in the intervening 14 months. Jeannie says I should repeat them now, even if they are more unnecessarily redundant than is absolutely called for by necessity. I just don't feel right doing so. It's not fair to subscribers who are expecting new material each time they come to the window. Some of you may remember every golden word I read to you last April. They were certainly memorable enough. And furthermore, it's just not necessary. If, for whatever reason, you missed any of those readings last year, or would just like to hear them again now, all 7 episodes in question are still available, free, at either my website, spiderrobinson.com, or at the iTunes store, same place you got this one. You can download them with exactly as much or little effort as it would take to download new versions. So, right now, I'd rather use this time to do what I promised you last time, and bring you a couple of short stories by one of the greatest SF writers who ever walked the earth, the immortal Ted Sturgeon. And immortality is tonight's theme, in a sense, because taken together, the two stories form a kind of suicide prevention kit. That is, the first one I'll read you kept me from doing myself in when I was about 17. And the second one I once read aloud to the sister of a very good friend after her 3rd serious suicide attempt, and my understanding is she's still around over 35 years later. They're the kind of work that made me want to be a writer in the first place, and to be the kind of writer I am. Both stories are brought to you now in this audio format by kind permission of Ted's daughter, Noelle Sturgeon. Noelle has just completed the great work begun by Paul Williams by editing and publishing the 12th and final installment in North Atlantic Books' superb quality hardcover edition of the complete short works of Theodore Sturgeon. This final volume is titled Slow Sculpture, after Ted's Hugo and Nebula Award-winning 1970 story, which I read to you 2 podcasts ago. And it also includes classics like Case and the Dreamer, The Widget, The Wadget, and Boff, and a story generally agreed to be the most profoundly and obscenely disgusting ever written, called Prusy's Pot, a little fiction so vile and so vowel that even National Lampoon hesitated to print it, and only one benighted pervert in history has ever sunk so low as to write an introduction for it, me. You will find that introduction in the aft matter of Slow Sculpture, and I recommend it for, among other things, a searing description of the pun contest with which Ted and I once nearly evacuated Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I mean that in the correct use of the word evacuated. And after the 2 Sturgeon readings, I will end this 71st episode of Spider on the Web by giving you all an update on the health of my beloved wife, Jeannie, and tell you all what is being done here and elsewhere to try and help her ensure it. But first, this musical interlude by Maria Muldaur in 74, White Girl Soul at the Hollywood Bowl, with Mr. Amos Garrett on lead guitar.
Come mellow down a little bit and do a tune Billie Holiday used to do called Lover Man. Where can you be? Oh!
Thank you, Maria. And now the title story of Volume 7 of the Complete Works of Theodore Sturgeon, A Saucer of Loneliness. If she's dead, I thought, I'll never find her in this white flood of moonlight on the white sea, with the surf seething in and over the pale, pale sand like a great shampoo. Almost always suicides who stab themselves or shoot themselves in the heart carefully bare their chests. The same strange impulse generally makes the sea suicide go naked. A little earlier, I thought, or later, and there would be shadows for the dunes and the breathing toss of the foam. Now the only real shadow was mine, a tiny thing just under me, but black enough to feed the blackness of the shadow of a blimp. A little earlier, I thought, and I might have seen her plodding up the silver shore, seeking a place lonely enough to die in. A little later, and my legs would rebel against this shuffling trot through sand, the maddening sand that could not hold and would not help a hurrying man. My legs did give way then, and I knelt suddenly, sobbing, not for her, not yet, just for air. There was such a rush about me, wind and tangled spray, and colors upon colors, and shades of colors that were not colors at all, but shifts of white and silver. If light like that were sound, it would sound like the sea on sand, and if my ears were eyes, they would see such a light. I crouched there, gasping in the swirl of it, and a flood struck me, shallow and swift, turning up and outward like flower petals where it touched my knees, then soaking me to the waist in its bubble and crash. I pressed my knuckles to my eyes so they would open again. The sea was on my lips with the taste of tears, and the whole white night shouted and wept aloud. And there she was. Her white shoulders were a taller curve in the sloping foam. She must have sensed me. Perhaps I yelled, for she turned and saw me kneeling there. She put her fists to her temples and her face twisted, and she uttered a piercing wail of despair and fury, and then plunged seaward and sank. I kicked off my shoes and ran into the breakers, shouting, hunting, grasping at flashes of white that turned to sea salt and coldness in my fingers. I plunged right past her, and her body struck my side as a wave whipped my face and tumbled both of us. I gasped in solid water, opened my eyes beneath the surface, and saw a greenish-white distorted moon hurtle as I spun. Then there was sucking sand under my feet again, and my left hand was tangled in her hair. The receding wave towed her away, and for a moment she streamed out from my hand like steam from a whistle. In that moment I was sure she was dead, but as she settled to the sand she fought and scrambled to her feet. She hit my ear, wet, hard, and a huge pointed pain lanced into my head. She pulled, she lunged away from me, and all the while my hand was caught in her hair. I couldn't have freed her if I had wanted to. She spun to me with the next wave, battered and clawed at me, and we went into deeper water. "Don't! Don't! I can't swim!" I shouted, so she clawed me again. "Leave me alone!" she shrieked. "Oh, dear God, why can't you leave?" said her fingernails. "Me!" said her fingernails. "Alone!" said her small hard fist. So by her hair I pulled her head down tight to her white shoulder, and with the edge of my free hand I hit her neck twice. She floated again, and I brought her ashore. I carried her to where a dune was between us and the sea's broad, noisy tongue, and the wind was above us somewhere, but the light was as bright. I rubbed her wrists and stroked her face and said, "It's all right," and "There," and some names I used to have for a dream I had long, long before I ever heard of her. She lay still on her back with the breath hissing between her teeth, with her lips in a smile which her twisted, tight, wrinkled, sealed eyes made not a smile but a torture. She was well and conscious for many moments, and still her breath hissed and her closed eyes twisted. "Why couldn't you leave me alone?" she asked at last. She opened her eyes and looked at me. She had so much misery that there was no room for fear. She shut her eyes again and said, "You know who I am." "I know," I said. She began to cry. I waited, and when she stopped crying, there were shadows among the dunes. A long time. She said, "You don't know who I am. Nobody knows who I am." I said, "It was in all the papers." "That!" She opened her eyes slowly, and her gaze traveled over my face, my shoulders, stopped at my mouth, touched my eyes for the briefest second. She curled her lips and turned away her head. "Nobody knows who I am." I waited for her to move or speak, and finally I said, "Tell me." "Who are you?" she asked, with her head still turned away. "Someone who..." "Well?" "Not now," I said. "Later, maybe." She sat up suddenly and tried to hide herself. "Where are my clothes?"
"I didn't see them."
"Oh," she said, "I remember. I put them down and kicked sand over them, just where a dune would come and smooth them over, hide them as if they never were. I hate sand. I wanted to drown in the sand, but it wouldn't let me."
"You mustn't look at me," she shouted. "I hate to have you looking at me."
She threw her head from side to side, seeking. "I can't stay here like this. What can I do? Where can I go?" "Here," I said. She let me help her up and then snatched her hand away, half turned from me.
"Don't touch me. Get away from me."
"Here," I said again, and walked down the dune where it curved in the moonlight, tipped back into the wind and down and became not dune but beach. "Here," I pointed behind the dune. At last she followed me. She peered over the dune where it was chest high and again where it was knee high.
"Back there?"
I nodded. "So dark." She stepped over the low dune and into the aching black of those moon shadows. She moved away cautiously, feeling tenderly with her feet, back to where the dune was higher. She sank down into the blackness and disappeared there. I sat on the sand in the light.
"Stay away from me," she spat.
I rose and stepped back. Invisible in the shadows, she breathed.
"Don't go away."
I waited, then saw her hand press out of the clean-cut shadows. "There," she said, "over there, in the dark. Just be a... stay away from me now. Be a voice." I did as she asked and sat in the shadows perhaps 6 feet from her. She told me about it. Not the way it was in the papers. She was perhaps 17 when it happened. She was in Central Park in New York. It was too warm for such an early spring day, and the hammered brown slopes had a dusting of green of precisely the consistency of that morning's hoarfrost on the rocks. But the frost was gone, and the grass was brave and tempted some hundreds of pairs of feet from the asphalt and concrete to tread on it. Hers were among them. The sprouting soil was a surprise to her feet, as the air was to her lungs. Her feet ceased to be shoes as she walked. Her body was consciously more than clothes. It was the only kind of day which in itself can make a city-bred person raise his eyes. She did. For a moment she felt separated from the life she lived, in which there was no fragrance, no silence, in which nothing ever quite fit nor was quite filled. In that moment the ordered disapproval of the buildings around the pallid park could not reach her. For 2-3 clean breaths, it no longer mattered that the whole wide world really belonged to images projected on a screen, to gently groomed goddesses in these steel and glass towers, that it belonged, in short, always, always to someone else. So she raised her eyes, and there above her was the saucer. It was beautiful. It was golden, with a dusty finish like that of an unripe Concord grape. It made a faint sound, a chord composed of 2 tones and a blunted hiss like the wind in tall wheat. It was darting about like a swallow, soaring and dropping. It circled and dropped and hovered like a fish, shimmering. It was like all these living things, but with that beauty it had all the loveliness of things turned and burnished, measured, machined, and metrical. At first she felt no astonishment, for this was so different from anything she had ever seen before that it had to be a trick of the eye, a false evaluation of size and speed and distance that in a moment would resolve itself into a sun flash on an airplane or the lingering glare of a welding arc. She looked away from it and abruptly realized that many other people saw it, saw something, too. People all around her had stopped moving and speaking and were craning upward. Around her was a globe of silent astonishment, and outside it she was aware of the life noise of the city, the hard-breathing giant who never inhales. She looked up again, and at last began to realize how large and how far away the saucer was. No, rather, how small and how very near it was. It was just the size of the largest circle she might make with her 2 hands, and it floated not quite 18 inches over her head. Fear came then. She drew back and raised a forearm, but the saucer simply hung there. She bent far sideways, twisted away, leaped forward, looked back and upward to see if she had escaped it. At first she couldn't see it, then, as she looked up and up, there it was, close and gleaming, quivering and crooning, right over her head. She bit her tongue. From the corner of her eye she saw a man cross himself. "He did that because he saw me standing here with a halo over my head," she thought. And that was the greatest single thing that had ever happened to her. No one had ever looked at her and made a respectful gesture before, not once, not ever. Through terror, through panic and wonderment, the comfort of that thought nestled into her, to wait to be taken out and looked at again in lonely times. The terror was uppermost now, however. She backed away, staring upward, stepping a ludicrous cakewalk. She should have collided with people. There were plenty of people there, gasping and craning, but she reached none. She spun around and discovered to her horror that she was the center of a pointing, pressing crowd. Its mosaic of eyes all bulged, and its inner circle braced its many legs to press back and away from her. The saucer's gentle note deepened. It tilted, dropped an inch or so. Someone screamed, and the crowd broke away from her in all directions, milled about, and settled again in a new dynamic balance, a much larger ring, as more and more people raced to thicken it against the efforts of the inner circle to escape. The saucer hummed and tilted, tilted. She opened her mouth to scream, fell to her knees, and the saucer struck. It dropped against her forehead and clung there. It seemed almost to lift her. She came erect on her knees, made 1 effort to raise her hands against it, and then her arms stiffened down and back, her hands not reaching the ground. For perhaps a second and a half, the saucer held her rigid, and then it passed a single ecstatic quiver to her body and dropped it. She plumped to the ground, the backs of her thighs heavy and painful on her heels and ankles. The saucer dropped beside her, rolled once in a small circle, once just around its edge, and lay still. It lay still and dull and metallic, different and dead. Hazily she lay and gazed at the gray-shrouded blue of the good spring sky, and hazily she heard whistles, then some tardy screams, and a great stupid voice bellowing, "Give her air!" which made everyone press closer. Then there wasn't so much sky because of the blue-clad bulk with its metal buttons and its leatherette notebook.
"Okay, okay, what's happening? Stand back, for God's sake."
And the widening ripples of observation, interpretation, and comment.
"It knocked her down.
Some guy knocked her down."
"He knocked her down. Some guy knocked her down, and right in broad daylight, this guy. This park's getting to be
onward and outward, the adulteration of fact, until it was lost altogether because excitement is so much more important. Somebody with a harder shoulder than the rest pulling close, a notebook here too, a witnessing eye over it, ready to change a beautiful brunette to an attractive brunette for the afternoon editions, because attractive is as dowdy as any woman is allowed to get if she is a victim in the news. The glittering shield and the florid face bending close.
"You hurt bad, sister?"
And the echoes back and back through the crowd.
Hurt bad, badly injured. He beat the hell out of her, broad daylight."
And still another man, slim and purposeful, tan gabardine, cleft chin and beard shadow.
"Flying saucer, hmm? Okay, officer, I'll take over here." "And who the hell might you be taking over?"
The flash of a brown leather wallet, a face so close behind that its chin was pressed into the gabardine's shoulder. The face said, awed,
"FBI."
And that rippled outward, too. The policeman nodded. The entire policeman nodded in one single bobbing genuflection.
"Get some help and clear this area," said the gabardine. "Yes, sir," said the policeman.
"FBI, FBI," the crowd murmured, and there was more sky to look at above her. She sat up, and there was glory in her face. "The saucer talked to me," she sang.
"You shut up," said the gabardine. "You'll have lots of chance to talk later." "Yes, sister," said the policeman. "My God, this mob could be full of communists." "You shut up, too," said the gabardine.
Someone in the crowd told someone else a communist beat up this girl, while someone else was saying she got beat up because she was a communist. She started to rise, but solicitous hands forced her down again. There were 30 police there by that time. "I can walk," she said.
"Now you just take it easy," they told her.
They put a stretcher down beside her and lifted her onto it and covered her with a big blanket. "I can walk," she said, as they carried her through the crowd. A woman went white and turned away moaning. "Oh, my God, how awful!" A small man with round eyes stared and stared at her and licked his lips. The ambulance. They slid her in. The gabardine was already there. A white-coated man with very clean hands.
"How did it happen, miss?" "No question," said the gabardine. "Security."
The hospital. She said, "I got to get back to work."
"Take your clothes off," they told her.
She had a bedroom to herself then, for the first time in her life. Whenever the door opened, she could see a policeman outside. It opened very often to admit the kind of civilians who were very polite to military people, and the kind of military people who were even more polite to certain civilians. She did not know what they all did, nor what they wanted. Every single day they asked her 4,500,000 questions. Apparently they never talked to each other, because each of them asked her the same questions over and over.
"What is your name? How old are you? What year were you born?"
Sometimes they would push her down strange paths with their questions.
"Now, your uncle married a woman from Middle Europe, did he? Where in Middle Europe? What clubs or fraternal organizations did you belong to? Ah, now, about that rinky-dink gang on 63rd Street, who was really behind it?"
But over and over again,
"What did you mean when you said the saucer talked to you?"
And she would say, "It talked to me." And they would say,
"And it said?"
And she would shake her head. There would be a lot of shouting ones and then a lot of kind ones. No one had ever been so kind to her before, but she soon learned that no one was being kind to her. They were just getting her to relax, to think of other things, so they could suddenly shoot that question at her.
"What do you mean to talk to you?"
Pretty soon, it was just like mom's or school or any place, and she used to sit with her mouth closed and let them yell. Once they sat her on a hard chair for hours and hours with a light on her eyes and let her get thirsty. Home, there was a transom over the bedroom door, and Mom used to leave the kitchen light glaring through it all night, every night, so she wouldn't get the horrors. So the light didn't bother her at all. They took her out of the hospital and put her in jail. Some ways it was good. the food. The bed was all right, too. Through the window she could see lots of women exercising in the yard. It was explained to her that they all had much harder beds.
You are a very important young lady, you know.
That was nice at first, but as usual it turned out they didn't mean her at all. They kept working on her. Once they brought the saucer in to her. It was inside a big wooden crate with a padlock and a steel box inside that with a Yale lock. It only weighed a couple of pounds, the saucer, but by the time they got it packed, it took two men to carry it and four men with guns to watch them. They made her act out the whole thing just the way it happened, with some soldiers holding the saucer over her head. It wasn't the same. They'd cut a lot of chips and pieces out of the saucer, and besides, it was that dead gray color. They asked her if she knew anything about that, and for once she told them. "It's empty now," she said. The only one she would ever talk to was a little man with a fat belly who said to her the first time he was alone with her, "Listen, I think the way they've been treating you stinks. Now get this, I have a job to do. My job is to find out why you won't tell what the saucer said. I don't want to know what it said, and I'll never ask you. I don't even want you to tell me. Let's just find out why you're keeping it a secret." Finding out why turned out to be hours of just talking about having pneumonia and the flower pot she made in second grade that Mom threw down the fire escape and getting left back in school and the dream about holding a wine glass in both hands and peeping over it at some man. And one day she told him why she wouldn't say about the saucer just the way it came to her. "Because it was talking to me and it's just nobody else's business." She even told him about the man crossing himself that day. It was the only other thing she had of her own. He was nice. He was the one who warned her about the trial. "I have no business saying this, but they're going to give you the full dress treatment, judge and jury and all. You just say what you want to say, no less and no more, here, and don't let them get your goat. You have a right to own something." He got up and swore and left. Well, first a man came and talked to her for a long time about how maybe this Earth would be attacked from outer space by beings much stronger and cleverer than we are, and maybe she had the key to a defense, so she owed it to the whole world. And then even if the Earth wasn't attacked, just think of what an advantage she might give this country over its enemies. Then he shook his finger in her face and said that what she was doing amounted to working for the enemies of her country. And he turned out to be the man that was defending her at the trial. The jury found her guilty of contempt of court, and the judge recited a long list of penalties he could give her. He gave her one of them and suspended it. They put her back in jail for a few more days, and one fine day they turned her loose. That was wonderful at first. She got a job in a restaurant and a furnished room. She had been in the papers so much that Mom didn't want her back home. Mom was drunk most of the time and sometimes used to tear up the whole neighborhood, but all the same, she had very special ideas about being respectable, and being in the papers all the time for spying was not her idea of being decent. So she put her maiden name on the mailbox downstairs and told her daughter not to live there anymore. At the restaurant, she met a man who asked her for a date. The first time. She spent every cent she had on a red handbag to go with her red shoes. They weren't the same shade, but anyway, they were both red. They went to the movies, and afterward he didn't try to kiss her or anything. He just tried to find out what the flying saucer told her. She didn't say anything. She went home and cried all night. Then some men sat in a booth talking, and they shut up and glared at her every time she came past. They spoke to the boss, and he came and told her that they were electronics engineers working for the government, and they were afraid to talk shop while she was around. Wasn't she some sort of spy or something? So she got fired. Once she saw her name on a jukebox. She put in a nickel and punched that number, and the record was all about the flying saucer came down one day and taught her a brand new way to play, and what it was I will not say, but she took me out of this world. And while she was listening to it, someone in the juke joint recognized her and called her by name. Four of them followed her home, and she had to block the door shut. Sometimes she'd be all right for months on end, and then someone would ask for a date. Three times out of five, she and the date were followed. Once, the man she was with arrested the man who was tailing them. Twice, the man who was tailing them arrested the man she was with. Five times out of five, the date would try to find out about the saucer. Sometimes she would go out with someone and pretend that it was a real date, but she wasn't very good at it. So she moved to the shore and got a job cleaning at night in offices and stores. There weren't many to clean, but that just meant there weren't many people to remember her face from the papers. Like clockwork, every 18 months, some feature writer would drag it all out again in a magazine or Sunday supplement. And every time anyone saw a headlight on a mountain or a light on a weather balloon, it had to be a flying saucer, and there had to be some tired quip about the saucer wanting to tell secrets. Then, for 2 or 3 weeks, she'd stay off the streets in the daytime. Once, she thought she had it whipped. People didn't want her, so she began reading. The novels were all right for a while, until she found out that most of them were like the movies, all about the pretty ones who really own the world. So she learned things. Animals. Trees. A lousy little chipmunk caught in a wire fence bit her. The animals didn't want her. The trees didn't care. Then she hit on the idea of the bottles. She got all the bottles she could and wrote on papers, which she corked into the bottles. She'd tramp miles up and down the beaches and throw the bottles out as far as she could. She knew that if the right person found one, it would give that person the only thing in the world that would help. Those bottles kept her going for 3 solid years. Everyone's got to have a secret little something he does. And at last the time came when it was no use anymore. You can go on trying to help someone who maybe exists, but soon you can't pretend there is such a person anymore. And that's it. The end. "Are you cold?" I asked her when she was through telling me. The surf was quieter and the shadows longer. "No," she answered from the shadows. Suddenly she said, "Did you think I was mad at you because you saw me without my clothes?"
"Why shouldn't you be?"
"You know, I don't care. I wouldn't have wanted you to see me even in a ball gown or overalls. You can't cover up my carcass. It shows. It's there, whatever. I just didn't want you to see me at all."
"Me or anyone?"
She hesitated. "You." I got up and stretched and walked a little, thinking.
"Didn't the FBI try to stop you throwing those bottles?"
"Oh, sure. They spent I don't know how much taxpayers' money gathering them up. They still make a spot check every once in a while. They're getting tired of it, though. All the writing in the bottles is the same."
She laughed. I didn't know she could. "What's funny?"
"All of them. Judges, jailers, jukeboxes, people. Do you know it wouldn't have saved me a minute's trouble if I'd told them the whole thing at the very beginning?"
"No?"
"No, they wouldn't have believed me. What they wanted was a new weapon, super science from a super race to slap the hell out of the super race if they ever got the chance, or out of our own if they don't. All those brains," she breathed with more wonder than scorn, "all that brass. They think super race and it comes out super science. Don't they ever imagine a super race has super feelings, too? Super laughter, maybe? Or super hunger?" She paused. "Isn't it time you asked me what the saucer said?"
"I'll tell you," I blurted.
"There is in certain living souls a quality of loneliness unspeakable, so great it must be shared as company is shared by lesser beings. Such a loneliness is mine, so know by this that in immensity there is one lonelier than you."
"Dear Jesus," she said devoutly, and began to weep.
"And how is it addressed?" "To the loneliest one."
"How did you know?" she whispered. "It's what you put in the bottles, isn't it?"
"Yes," she said. "Whenever it gets to be too much, that no one cares, that no one ever did, you throw a bottle into the sea, and out goes a part of your own loneliness. You sit and think of someone, somewhere, finding it, learning for the first time that the worst there is can be understood." The moon was setting and the surf was hushed. We looked up and out to the stars. She said,
We don't know what loneliness is like. People thought the saucer was a saucer, but it wasn't. It was a bottle with a message inside. It had a bigger ocean to cross, all of space, and not much chance of finding anybody. Loneliness? We don't know loneliness. When I could, I asked her why she had tried to kill herself. I've had it good, she said, with what the saucer told me. I wanted to pay back. I was bad enough to be helped. I had to know I was good enough to help. No one wants me? Fine, but don't tell me no one anywhere wants my help. I can't stand that. I took a deep breath. I found one of your bottles 2 years ago. I've been looking for you ever since. Tide charts, current tables, maps, and wandering. I heard some talk about you in the bottles here about. Someone told me you'd quit doing it. You'd taken to wandering the dunes at night. I knew why. I ran all the way. I needed another breath now. I got a club foot. I think right, but the words don't come out of my mouth the way they're inside my head. I have this nose. I never had a woman. No one ever wanted to hire me to work where they'd have to look at me. You're beautiful, I said. You're beautiful. She said nothing, but it was as if a light came from her, more light and far less shadow than ever the practiced moon could cast. Among the many things it meant was that even to loneliness there is an end for those who are lonely enough, long enough. That was A Saucer of Loneliness by the immortal Theodore Sturgeon, and here's another immortal who just left the party at age 93, the great Les Paul. Les drove over from New Jersey every Monday night for the last several decades to play at the Iridium in New York City. I just passed up a chance to catch him there last month because I couldn't afford the tickets. He used to jam with people like Paul McCartney or whoever fell by. But this is the man they called the Wizard of Waukesha, Wisconsin, in the adjacent city of Pewaukee. You can mill around Milwaukee, but you have to pee in Pewaukee. 2 years ago, when Les was still just a young pup of 91.
Thank you. That's for you guys. Thank you.
That was the Les Paul Trio with John Colliani on piano, Lou Paolo on rhythm guitar, and Nicky Parrott on upright bass. Now, without further ado, here's the second story I promised you, Suicide by Theodore Sturgeon. Boyle jumped. He did it. He really and truly did it. They say that when the end comes, no matter how swiftly, there's time enough for your whole life to pass before your eyes. That's not strictly true. It would take a real lifetime to do that, but there is time enough for a hell of a lot. However, Boyle discovered, as others had before him, that you get a lot of pictures all out of order. Yes, and sounds, too. Voices speaking a word or two, laughing. A shout that reaches you at last from years away and means what the shouter meant instead of what you always thought it meant. In such a moment, everything makes sense. Some of the images and noises are apparently trivial. Aunt Edith saying, "Please pass the salt," and how Hank always used to have one sock up and one down when they were little kids, and things like that. Then there are the replays of things you know aren't trivial and never were. Like the time you had to go to Scranton and Kay said suddenly, "Don't go, please don't go," and you knew damn well she was going to sleep with somebody that night and wanted you out of the way, and yet she said that, and you went to Scranton anyway. And Krieger saying, "Boyle, you know you'd be happier in some other line," which meant out, never mind those years and all that sweat and loyalty and the pipe dreams of the big desk with the opaline letters on a chalk facing the door. He jumped. He jumped, and sure there was terror. There always is when you're falling. There often is when it's dark. And sure there was regret, and if only I had it to do all over again. He had expected, and he got, a couple of brand new ideas to cure it all. Just walk up to him and say, just show her once and for all that he take a loan on, a lot of stuff like that, and under and around it all, a deep glee. I made it. Boyle did not fail. I said I would do it, and I did. That ought to prove something to the whole son of a bitch and bunch of them. That's about as far as he got before something in the dark took his foot and turned him. The wind was different as it whirled past his face, and he found himself looking incredulously past his feet at the stars, with the great bulk of the cliff face blotting out a third of the sky. Then the lights, 10,000 lights in the valley below over his head, a million lights in the sky under his feet, were eclipsed by 10 million more inside his head as he got a shower of cruel thumps and 100 long numb scrapes that would be agony if he lived long enough for the shock to wear off, but he wouldn't, and the lights went out. "Don't go. Please don't go." The voice was soft and quite clear and close. He opened his eyes and could see the silhouette of her head as she bent close. He could even feel the stirring of the hairs over his temple stir to her breath. He blinked once, and it wasn't her head or anyone's head. It was the bulk of the mountain against the sky. For a foolish flash, he thought he might still be in midair, falling, but a single twitch of his cheek told him he was not. Falling through the unresisting air, you do not feel pebbles and dirt ground into your flayed cheek. He shook his head to clear it, and his whole body moved, slid. It was only a few inches, but it was enough to pack dirt and rubble into his collar and send a shocking stab of pain from somewhere low on his right leg right up through his body. Or maybe it was down. Up was still down for him. Cautiously he looked over his head and saw lights. Stars? No, for they were in rows and patterns. They were the same as the lights on the valley floor. They were the lights of the valley floor. He was lying on a spur of the mountain, on his back and head down, and the ground under him was tilted like a pitched roof. He looked quickly past his feet, and there were the stars, and again he slid an inch or two. He suddenly and appallingly realized that if he twitched like that once or twice more, if he slid just far enough, fast enough so he did not stop, he was going to go right over that ragged edge down there. Slowly and very carefully, he studied out where his hands were. One was on the ground at his side, the other across his stomach. He raised this one and put it to the ground, too. The left hand could find only loose pebbles and earth which slipped up, down, past him hopping and hissing when he moved his fingers and bounded away into blank space somewhere past his head. Not very far, either. The right hand rested on what seemed like a more solid piece of rock. Carefully, not daring to turn his head to look, knowing it was too dark to see anyway, he explored it with his fingertips. There was an edge there. More. It was a crack, an inch wide. He could not discover how long it was, nor how deep. He curled his fingers into it, and it felt wonderful. He stopped moving for a time and indulged himself in the joy of feeling it. He had known this feeling once before, when he had bought his first new car. This is mine. This belongs to me. He let his fingertips creep in and slide out again, very much the way he had let his proud hand stray over the new-smelling upholstery and dashboard. How wonderful to own a crack in a rock. He tried to hook his heels into something and edge himself uphill a bit, but there was nothing but loose dirt and pebbles up there and an explosion of pain from his right leg, and his whole body told him it was about to slip again toward that edge down up there past his head. He got his right fingers as deep as they would go into the crack and stopped to think. The fear began then, and it wouldn't let him think. It rose and flooded over him and left him weak, with puddles of it here and then over his whole soul like tidal pools. He knew there would be other waves of it, too. Fear numbs your brain. Fear can weaken, can paralyze your fingers, can draw them out of that precious crack in the rocks, which is the only possession left to you in the head-down, lumpy, sliding universe. He bit his teeth together until they hurt. It was a pain different from the other pains which writhed and racked and skewered him, because it was a pain he did himself and could shut off himself. That may seem like a small thing, but it isn't. When a helpless man finds he can do anything, anything at all, he isn't helpless anymore, even if the thing he does is useless. It was a strange thing he began to do. He began clenching and unclenching his jaw, and he found it was like a pump, emptying him of fear. He knew he could never get it all down to the last drop, but he didn't need that. He just wanted to get rid of enough of it so he could think again. Slowly, he brought his left hand across his body and as far as he could toward the right. The one hand found the other, and the straining fingertips explored the ground next to it. The crack was full of dry dirt, and he dug clumsily to remove it. The effort increased the pressure of his whole body to slide, and the rock under his right hand began to press back. He realized suddenly that the right hand would tire, would simply wear out and quit if that pressure grew much larger or lasted too long. He sank his left fingers in the crack as deep as they would go. He had to rotate his body slightly for this, and all his plans to move slowly and carefully evaporated in another great wash of terror as his body started to slide. He half sat up and whipped over to get his hands side by side into the crack. His body slid around the two hands as a pivot point, and all around him loose rocks moved in a small cascade, rustling and whispering and ending in a terrible silence just downslope from him as they leaped out into black space. When at last all movement ended, he was lying belly down, with both hands deep in the crack, and he couldn't see anything anymore. But at least his head was upslope, and that seemed to do something for him. He wheezed for breath and spit out dirt. He lay there panting until it hurt a little less to breathe, and he was immediately sorry for that, because the relative relaxation made him able to inventory other sensations. The one which rose over all others like a shout above a murmur was his right leg. He could feel nothing with it but a great constant blare of agony. Something very awful had happened to that leg. His other one seemed all right. He shifted it a little. He could feel the knee grinding into the mountain and the shin, but nothing below that. He waggled his foot. He felt nothing with it, and then realized with dreadful clarity that his 2 feet were projecting over the edge of the precipice. The realization brought another great towering surf of fear. He used what he had learned about that. When terror comes, you dig in and hold hard and let it roar past and slither back. Don't drown. Don't let go. In a second or a minute or perhaps in an age or so, fear will subside. Even if it leaves pieces of itself through and through you, you will, sooner or later, get to where you can think again. He resettled the grip of his two hands and pulled. His body slid painfully a fraction of an inch, and he heard the beginnings of that whispering rustle as pebbles and dirt began to slide all around him. "Well, slide if you want to," he told them madly. "I'm not going to." He went the other way. He went up. Not much, not quickly, and certainly not easily. When he drew his feet up over the edge, he was penalized bitterly and richly rewarded. The pain in his right leg, when the foot touched the slope and turned, was far past anything he had ever known in all his life, and he cowered down under it and begged it not to make him faint and loosen his grip. But the left toe, seeking like some blind animal, found a little purchase and sent help like a regiment of cavalry and a cowboy and Indian picture. Ta-da! And helped his crackling fingers to move him uphill. It was one of the most glorious moments he had ever known when he drew himself up so his lips were even with his hands. Driven by some impulse he could never have explained, he laughed a short, hoarse laugh and put his tongue into the crack of the rocks between his hands. Then he lay there quietly, half dozing, half smiling, until it was time to move again. Now the pulling was a pushing as he pressed the crack down his body, past his chest, past his stomach. When his hands were fully extended downward, he rested again, and then began to draw his left leg. He didn't dare raise himself to his knees yet, and had to bring the leg out and sideways until his hip joint all but whimpered for him to stop, but he would not. Most grudgingly, the left leg began to take the burden, and the more it straightened out, the more able it became. He slid upward. He dared to reach forward and found a few shreds of grass, no help in themselves, but their roots were a tight hummock. He felt it shift when he pulled, so he took it very easy. He got both hands on it and let his left foot say a heartfelt thank you and goodbye to the crack in the rock, and drew it upward again. The slope was a little less here, and he found it possible to draw his knee straight upward instead of to the side as before. A luxury, an elegance, to be able to do that. His right leg was molten torture. He gritted his teeth against that. He said to himself, now I've just got to switch that off. You do not, of course, switch off the pain of a broken leg. You act as if you could, as if you had. Then somehow you can keep moving. The slope now was still easier. He stopped to look up. This must have been about where he struck and slid after he jumped. He could not see very well. There was only starlight and the dimmest possible glow from the valley lights. But the cliff above him rose up impossibly sheer, and the nearly level spur on which he lay was not very wide, perhaps 15 or 20 feet. He crawled up to the base of the cliff and turned gingerly over, lifting his broken leg with both hands, and let himself down with his back to the rock. He was so tired and so winded and in such pain that the distant lights blurred and whirled, and yet the simple act of sitting, of actually sitting down and leaning back against something, made him feel favored to the point of luxuriousness. Then it all disappeared into a black and comfortable slumber before he could get it sorted out in his mind. When he awoke, it was in the gray suggestion of false dawn. For a moment he clutched the earth to right and left and looked across the valley with vertigo. So far away, those lights, so far down. Then the memory flooded back of those minutes. Hours, was it, when he lay on his back with his head downhill and one hand in a crack in the rock, and he looked around him as he sat with his back against the cliff and almost smiled. He rocked back and forth to get the blood circulating in his buttocks and legs, and then pressed and clawed himself upright, grunting against the stabs of pain. He rested a moment, standing, then fumbled his fly open and urinated. He didn't push, he just let it happen. There was something very wonderful about the sound of it and the faint, warm, familiar, acrid smell. It wasn't that anything was running out of him, it was more that something alive was happening here, and it was important just because of that. When he was finished, he zipped up and looked to right and left. Tumbling rainwater had carved an angled gully down to the shelf on which he stood. It wasn't smooth, nor wide, nor especially safe. Some of it looked like loose and crumbling earth rather than rock, and it was steep. He began to climb it. He climbed for nearly 5 hours. It was only about 60 feet. Once he had to stop to build a road of pebbles and root ends and a rock or two, anything he could reach and pack in, a road all of 4 feet long. Once he slept for a time. Twice he fainted when earth fell away from under him and he had to leap to save himself, twisting his injured leg. And in the fourth and fifth hours, something strange happened to Boyle.
he began to hurry. It was the hurry that caused the second of these faints, and when he recovered, he had to crouch there for a time and think it out and wonder why he had hurried, because if there was no reason, then it wasn't smart to go on hurrying, right? All he could think of was that he wanted to make the top before anyone could come to help him. He didn't understand that at all, so he put it out of his mind, but he stopped pushing quite so hard. But when he reached the top, he couldn't make it. There was no way to make it. The little crooked, sometimes there, sometimes not, sometimes rock, sometimes earth, gully ended in a narrow crack in an overhang. Boyle sat down under the overhang and looked out over the valley. It was daylight now, and all but a few of the lights were gone. The sun wasn't up yet, but the distant skyline was black and sharp, and the sky above it had turned from gray to pearl and was beginning to show a cast of pink. He looked up at the underside of that overhang, and he suddenly began to get mad. Among the rubble lying around was a narrow, pointed, flat stone about 18 inches long. He picked it up and hefted it, and then began to dig at the overhang. He dug in and up, and earth fell away and went hissing down, and he dug some more. He got expert very quickly on how much he could dig before lumps and clumps of it would fall away. He uncovered some roots and dug around them until further in. They weren't threads and strings, but rods and bleached boughs, something to hold to while he reached further, dug deeper. His arms and his back and the left leg, which was bearing all his weight, began to ache, and then it was more than an ache. It was something that strove to match the torture of his broken right leg. He seemed to be operating some weird sort of contest to see if he could make the rest of his body hurt as much as that leg. He delved inward, making a sort of cave into the cliffside, knowing perfectly well that if he undercut enough, he had more than an even chance of bringing the whole thing down on himself and going with it down into the valley, but the odds suited him, and he wouldn't quit. For the 100th time, he looked up to gauge the soft material over his head, and when it happened, he almost didn't see it, didn't see that the ceiling above him was abruptly lower. It was actually moving when he dropped his stone tool and grasped roots with both hands, twisting them around his wrists and hanging on with all his might. Almost silently, the overhang collapsed, and for a black, choking moment he was totally certain he had buried himself. Then the crushing weight slid off his back, and he heard the rumble of earth and rocks receding downhill, and shook his head free and opened his eyes. There was no more overhang. Where the rain gully had begun in a narrow slit, there was a wide V slanting down from the top in a natural 2-to-1 slope and full of roots. He bellied into it and clawed his way to the top, and with a kind of joy, 30 level feet further before he collapsed. He lay there for a long time without even trying to think. Then at last he rolled over, handling his hurt leg as if it was a fragile possession of someone else's, and sat up to look across the valley at the tip of the sun as it pressed up out of its slot behind the hills. All it said to him was that this was a new day, and he didn't have to think about that a lot. What he did think of, as he sat there in his new day waiting for someone to come along, was the two questions he hadn't asked himself, not for a second during all those terrible hours. Why had he jumped? Why had he climbed? Just sitting here, watching the sun come up. That was all the answer he needed for the second one. And the first one just didn't matter anymore. Right? He asked himself. Right, he said. Now here's Lambert Hendrickson Ross live in Bremen in 1962, the unbelievable John Hendricks singing some of his most astonishing lyrics to the song Cloudburst.
I found your love, and that's the old great cloudburst. be satisfied. Do you play? Here comes the bride. Listen to me, baby, and don't we make this a simple story? It's terrifically true. I want to find a way to tell you that I really go. Will you over here believe me, baby? Because you certainly do. But you're thrilling me, really, really thrilling when you tell me that you probably got a kind of crush on me. It moves me, proves me. How divine can one woman be? Oh, little darling, I'm really falling. You got me goofy and gay. I'm gonna get carried away. Just think you're gonna be mine someday. Oh, let's feel a little pop, a little stop, a little spark, a little live, a little love, a little baby, turtle love, a little baby. Every time you're home, you're so near. Nobody loves me like you, dear. Let's stop a little tease, a little lady, baby, speed, a little try, a little sigh, a little never have to cry, a little bit. No denying that you're mighty pretty and that's it. Love you, baby, 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 with all my heart. Ooh, listen to me, wanna say a little, lot of little, baby, get away, because I know, pretty baby, I know, pretty baby, I know, you're the one, yes, you're the one, I knew it, when I met you, what a break to get you. Take a look at me, boy. Take another look, take another look, take another look, take another good long look at me. I've opened my eyes and now I see. Found the gray hands of lightning's when they reverse. I found your love, and that's when the old great cloud burst. That's when the old great cloud burst.
Thank you, Lambert Hendrickson Ross. Okay, before I go, I feel a need to clarify Jeannie's medical situation. We have both talked ourselves hoarse on that subject since about last February, through many changes, and have lost track of just exactly what we told to exactly who, and furthermore, our own natural instinct from the start has been to downplay things to keep such personal matters private. Ha! Fat chance. It is simply not humanly possible to not talk about having cancer, or having a spouse who is dealing with it. Nor is it possible to keep telling the same story over and over again and not leaving parts out. So now some of our friends are going, oh, wait a minute, Jeannie, that surgery of yours was for cancer? And others are saying, what's this about a benefit concert for you? I thought you beat it. And anyway, you live in one of those countries with socialized medicine. What do you need money for? So it's time to bring everybody up to speed. Several months ago, the brilliant Dr. Andre Buschkowski helped Jeannie beat back a rare and virulent form of biliary cancer with 9.5 hours of creative surgery removing her gallbladder, common bile duct, and 3/4 of her liver. But her syndrome, Maritzi's, is so rare, even Dr. B can't say how much time he's bought her, how soon it might recur. If it does, no further surgery will be possible. For technical reasons, she is not a candidate for either radiation or chemo. Her only hope for long-term survival now is therefore to reboot and reinvigorate her failed immune system. She needs special therapies and meds and supplements, extensive diet and lifestyle changes, and a stress level as close to zero as possible. All those are expensive. None are covered by even Canada's excellent medical care. And like many artists today, if not most, we were already running on fumes financially when this came up. But Jeannie, a Soto Zen monk, has been spreading love and kindness around in all directions for a long time now, ever since I've known her. So her Buddhist Sangha in Vancouver, Mountain Rain Zen, our neighbors on Bowen Island, and friends as far away as Florida have all spontaneously come together to raise funds to help keep her around as long as possible. Your participation is welcomed. A Bowen Island benefit concert, We Dream for Jeannie, will be held at Cates Hill Chapel at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, September 18th. For details, go to http://wedreamforjeannie.blogspot.com/. That's Jeannie, J-E-A-N-N-E. Checks can always be sent to Mountain Rain Zen Center at 6183 Fraser Street, F-R-A-S-E-R Street, Vancouver, B.C., postal code V5W2Z9, Canada. Goods or services can be donated for eBay auction by contacting Jan Schroeder at dreamforjeannie@aol.com.
My friend and colleague Don DeBrandt, for example, will use the name of the highest bidder for a vampire, werewolf, or golem in his next novel as D.D. Barrant, Death Blows, which he describes as, quote, either an urban fantasy, paranormal mystery, or supernatural romance, take your pick, unquote. And if you'd like to simply send a PayPal donation, by Monday, 24 August, there will be a hot link for that purpose at http://wedreamforgenie.blogspot.com/. As a Buddhist, Jeannie's been contemplating her own death for as long as I've known her. She's not afraid. She's also not in any hurry at all to go, nor I to let her. She and I both warmly appreciate your help, support, prayers, or just good thoughts. So does our grandchild, Marissa Alegria, presently enjoying her third month as an earthling. Here, for her and her mom, Terry Luana, here's Leon Russell to take us all home with his classic ballad, A Song for You.
In my life and time, I've sung a lot of songs, I made some bad rhymes. I've acted out my life on stages with 10,000 people watching. Whoa. But we're alone now and I'm singing this song to you. Know your image of me is what I hope to be. I treated you unkindly, but can't you see? There's no one more important to me. Darling, can you please see through me? Whoa. Cause we're alone now and I'm singing this song to you. You taught me precious secrets, drew with holding nothing. You came out in front and I was fighting. But now I'm so much better. If the words don't come together, listen to the melody, my love in their hiding. Love you in a place where there's no space and time. I love you for my life, you are a friend of mine. When my life is over, remember when we were together. Oh, we were alone and I was singing this song to you. Space and time. I love you for my life. You are a friend of mine. When my life is over, remember when we were together. Whoa. We were alone and I was singing this song for you. We were alone and I was singing this song for you. Cause we're alone now and I'm singing my song
singing this song to you.